Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey guys, welcome to another very special podcast, because today you don't get big cheese.
That's right, you get larger, slightly smellier cheese. Me, Nathan.
That's right, so my dad Roman is out on a press trip driving the new Lexus LX. So instead you get myself, Tommy, and Nathan, and what are we talking about today?
Underappreciated vehicles. Some that might rightfully be underappreciated, and others that perhaps truly are underappreciated.
Yeah, so I put together a list. Nathan is going to agree or disagree with me, but these are vehicles from recent past that didn't get a lot of respect, were not very popular when they were new, but are actually insanely good vehicles to buy used, or in some cases, new.
That's correct. But before we go there, we wanted to say thank you very much to Patreon support, because you guys are awesome.
Yeah, in case you haven't noticed, we don't have crazy ad breaks in this podcast. So that is in a huge part to our Patreon supporters. So if you want to help us out, check us out on Patreon in the link below. And Nathan, should we get to the list?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so going in alphabetical order, we've got a whole bunch of brands. I know I've missed a few brands because I couldn't think of some cars, but maybe Nathan can help me out. So first up, starting with the A's, this is a car that was much, probably disliked when it was new and is still arguably disliked by a lot today, but the Acura ZDX. What am I talking about?
He's talking about a vehicle that essentially is a smaller version of an MDX that was built specifically to hold kind of sort of five people, but because it is such a genius job with slicing the back off and making it a fastback design, people in the backseat have to lean forward if they're over, say, 5'7". Now, there's something very interesting about this car, Tommy, and it has to do with you and, more importantly, your father.
Oh, geez, what did I do?
You're related to the man who actually loved it.
I know.
Your dad loved this thing, and I don't get, I honestly do not get it. He wanted one.
All right, I agree. So hear me out on this one, because I, for some reason, love it too. So nowadays, it's like become such a cliche where every car company has to have an SUV, and then they chop the butt off, and they make a coupe SUV.
Every car company has done that.
Right, and now you're like, oh, I'm just sick of it, and they're less practical. And for the most part, I agree.
Yeah.
But the ZDX was, in my opinion, one of the very first cars ever to do this trend, and I think to do it well. So like you mentioned, like an MDX, very similar to an MDX, but it's got some incredible, almost concept car proportions, and I just think it's beautiful, especially from the back. This was a really, really cool design. And Nathan, you noticed something really interesting about
it. Yes, I did. Before we went on, now for those of you who are able to see this, you can see that the image is right over Tommy's shoulder. If you're listening to the podcast, the ZDX has a very unique design, but one that's actually kind of familiar. For those of you who do not know, or for those of you who perhaps do know, Acura recently reintroduced the Integra.
Ooh.
And the Integra is a fastback design. And if you look at that Integra and you look at the ZDX, you may notice something. They're almost identical, with the exception of the fact that the ZDX is higher off the ground and has a slightly taller body. The design, the roof line is like really, really close. Even the rear end design, surprisingly close, to the point to where you're like, bro, this design is like, what, almost 10 years old, right?
Yeah.
The ZDX. And they're doing the same thing again. And the funny part is, on a car, a regular car, I don't really mind this type of five-spec design. I get it. It's for aerodynamics and it looks sleek and blah, blah, blah. Audi does it well. But when you do it to an SUV, especially one that when you're sitting in the back seat, and this happened at the auto show, Tommy, when we were there, I was sitting behind Roman in this vehicle with the person from Audi there. And she said, it's a very roomy vehicle, and I'm shorter than Roman. And I was leaning forward because my head hit the roof. It's not a design that's very logical. It makes no sense to anybody who wants to own one. And most importantly, they didn't sell any.
Yeah, okay. So, the ZDX was kind of a sales failure.
Yes.
And you are 1,000% right. It's not practical.
Yes.
You are also, I cannot believe that you noticed this, but I'm just looking at a picture of the rear of the brand new Integra, and it looks identical.
Guys, am I right?
Like the C-pillar design is the same. The basic taillight architecture is the same. That's crazy. It's just a little lower than the ZDX.
Exactly. It's nuts.
So, Nathan, it's time for you to decide. ZDX underappreciated good or underappreciated? It deserves to remain so.
It deserves to remain so. It sounds like an Italian dish that should be forgotten.
All right, well, I lost that one. But it's time to move on to the next brand, moving away from the A's into the B's. The BMW in this case, and I think this is a really good car, which not a lot of people bought for a lot of reasons, but the BMW i3.
Ah, I have a very different opinion about the i3.
Okay, so let me make my argument for it first. Now,
please.
Globally, they actually did sell quite a few of these. And in the U.S., it did okay, but the i3 was a ground-up electric vehicle that launched for the 2014 model year. So it was very space-age stuff in 2014. It had like a carbon monocoque design. It didn't have a traditional steel or aluminum body structure. It was very ingenious in its powertrain. So it was an electric model, which only did like 80 miles at the launch.
Roughly, yeah.
And then kind of grew eventually to 120 and then 150 miles. But the range extender was a super smart idea. It's got a little motorcycle engine in it. The interior design has all these floating elements with this funky steering wheel. And yes, when it was new, like $50,000, way overpriced.
Yeah.
Nowadays, they're like 15, 16 grand. Andre has one.
Yes.
And I think that it was an extremely undervalued and underappreciated car in today's market. Now, what's your thought about it?
I completely agree with you, 100%.
Wow.
As weird as it looks, and it does look really weird, it is a futuristic vehicle in every sense of the word because it was, as he said, ground up, built for being an electric vehicle, being efficient and still a BMW. It's actually fun to drive. And that's one of the reasons why I liked them.
Yeah.
It was one of the first vehicles that really gave me the feeling of one pedal driving, which I love doing.
Mm.
But very few vehicles really do it right. This one did it right. Even though it has narrow wheels, the wheels, seriously, there are motorcycles, regular motorcycles with wider wheels. But there's a point to this, and that is for efficiency. And they still, I drove one in the snow and it did okay. It was a sport model. Couple things. I really do wish they had a little bit more, I think it's about a 2 gallon tank for the fuel.
Yeah,
roughly.
It's tiny.
And the whole point is that it charges up the battery and it really does work as just a generator, right? I wish that was a little bit larger or the battery was a little bit larger,
right,
one way or the other. I think it would be a fantastic electric car if it could do 250, 300 miles.
Yeah.
But there's just no room for it. When they built that vehicle, they were constrained by the fact that they needed a light platform, one that didn't really have the space for batteries, so it's kind of a trade-off. So I wish they built a slightly larger version of that, just a slightly larger version. One final thing, actually relatively comfortable for four people. Unfortunately, it's a clamshell style door in the back, so your kids cannot hop out until you let them out, which is awesome for some parents, but you can't hold a fifth person in the back seat. That's another issue. So,
great point.
Yeah, but other than that, it's such a smart, unique design. And they're safe, by the way. You should look at their safety scores. They're quite good.
Yeah.
Really interesting car. I agree with Tommy on this one.
And the great thing is nowadays you can pick them up for like I said, 15, 16 grand. And they were 50 grand a few years ago.
Yes, easily. And they're still selling them, I believe. Or they just stopped. Okay,
yeah.
They just stopped for 22. So 2 years ago, I was cross shopping, believe it or not, one of those with my daughter's car. And she has a Nissan Leaf.
Oh.
And she had the one with the larger battery, so a 30 kilowatt hour battery. And honestly, there was like about a $2,000 difference. And really, the only thing that stopped me was the fact that the Leaf had a little bit more usable cargo space.
Yeah.
And it was just a little bit cheaper.
Four doors.
Yeah, proper four doors.
The i3 It's funny you bring up the gas tank. So they kind of had a snafu with the EPA and the i3. So they had a 2-gallon, I think it was, gas tank installed. Mm-hmm. But they realized when they were certifying with the EPA, in order for it to be considered a battery electric vehicle with the range extender, it had to go further on electricity than gasoline. Otherwise, it would just be a standard plug-in hybrid.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
So the solution was to software limit how much gas you could use. Oh, so when the car ran out of gas, it still really had like half a gallon left. But because they wanted that EPA certification for a battery electric, they didn't give you access to the full battery or the full tank. So what you can do now in the aftermarket is you buy a thing, you plug in the OBD. Andre did this. We did a little video on it. And you can unlock that other half gallon.
But I mean, it helps for range, right? I mean,
to this day in the U.S., it's the only ever range extender sold. I mean, not a plug-in hybrid, but just a little tiny 30-horsepower motorcycle engine to get you to the charger.
Now, Mazda was about to introduce it, and they fell on their face. And they have a vehicle now that has no range.
The X30, yeah.
Yeah, but I hear that the range extender is coming soon, and it's going to be a rotary one. And I'm really looking forward to that because I actually really dig rotary design. So let's move on.
Yeah, so next up. Continuing with the Bs, and I think you're going to agree with me on this one. You spent a lot of time in this car when it was new. Mm. The Buick Regal GS.
Love that car. And you could get a manual transmission with it, too.
Could you?
Yes. Yeah. There were a lot of, actually, the Buick Regal GS is really underrated. Now, I know it is based on a Opel design. Essentially, it's just rebadged. But it did so many things well. First of all, power was extraordinary for a car in its class. There was an all-wheel drive. Roman and I actually went to Canada and we drove an all-wheel drive one on the ice and actually had a really good time doing that. I don't know if you remember that video, Tommy.
I do. I was pretty young, but yeah.
Was that Montreal? I think it was Montreal. And we had a blast. Very solid car, crap back seat. The worst part about it, I mean, such a great car. I loved it. And I really loved driving the manual. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but it was so much fun. And then all of a sudden, you know, you try to put people in the back. And back then, my sister, who's 5'1 and change, and probably, I don't know, 120 soaking wet, she was uncomfortable in the back seat. And it's just like, this car is so great. But they just didn't design the back seat right, not for a Buick.
Now, if we look at the GS, the first generation, which launched at the 2010 auto show, it had like 270 horsepower, which was, I mean, it's a lot of power.
It is.
295 pound-feet of torque as well. All-wheel drive, I think, too, isn't it?
All-wheel drive was so you could get the manual front-wheel drive, I believe, and then all-wheel drive was with the automatic transmission.
Interesting.
They were both brilliant. And then they had the front-end design was actually very unique. They actually had, and I don't remember the name of it, it was like Active Strut or something like that, where it really did an excellent job keeping the front-end super, super planted. And back in the days when Buick actually built cars, that was a really fun car to drive. Now, if they were able to get away with that much power and performance and make it as long as, say, the LeSabre or something like that, I'm just throwing a name from the past out there, so your back passengers could actually be comfortable, they would sell more of those. The Buick Regal had a variety of different types of spinoffs, and they were all brilliant, but they all suffered from one of the big issues of not enough backseat room.
Now, there was, of course, it was technically the sixth generation of Regal, which came out, I think, in 2018. Mm-hmm. I want to give an honorary mention to one other Buick, and I don't know if you'll agree with me on this one, but you remember there was one with Angry Bird taillights called the Verano? It had like these angry taillights. But it was a little baby Buick sedan.
Oh, that was based on the Chevy Cruze, wasn't it?
I could have been. I'm not quite sure.
That's the little four-cylinder?
Yeah, turbo, but a manual transmission.
Yes. That I believe, was based on the Chevy Cruze platform. So that was their little one, and it only lasted a few years. That is a worthy honorable mention. I would imagine that right now they're super dirt cheap.
I bet so, yeah. And the Regal, like you said, based on the Opel Insignia, this was like the start of the Opel Buick deal, where a Buick started rebranding Opels. But do you agree with me, Regal?
Yes, 100%.
Good, underappreciated?
Yeah, really, really good car, if you don't mind a small backseat.
All right, let's move on to the next brand. I've got Cadillac on the list, and I have two, and I don't know how you feel about these. Mm. So the first choice, the CTS-V wagon.
Oh, yes. There's a funny joke about the CTS-V wagon. A lot of people out there don't realize that journalists have really bad taste in cars sometimes. And the funny thing is that they say that all the CTS-V wagons manuals, which you could get a manual version of it, were sold to journalists, all of them brown.
That's funny.
Or something, you know what I mean? Something along those lines. And you know, I hate to admit it, but I was one of those journalists who was seriously thinking about it. I tried to convince my wife, this is before we had to buy a house, honey, we can afford one of these. I think it had 556 horsepower.
Oh, it was crazy at the time.
Yeah. And even by today's standards, this thing ripped. It sounded like a P51 Mustang on the outside. The volume on the inside wasn't great, but it did a lot of things really well in terms of performance, and yet it had the utility of a wagon. Americans don't like wagons. I can't help that. I've tried. You know I've tried. I've tried to convince them that wagons are a great thing to get. And we had, at the time, a baby. Your dad and I went to Leadville in one.
Okay.
And we did a great video. This is one of our early day TFL videos. And anyway, I brought it home, and I opened the trunk up, and my wife's like, well, let's put the stroller in there. Put the stroller in there. It was great. Let's put a bike in there. I threw a bike in there. You know, everything was a piece of cake. Everything fit in there. And then we get into the car, and I start driving. I go onto the highway, and then I let it rip. And my wife's like, no, you're not getting this. And it was like, yeah, okay, I get it, honey. And not only that, I think I was like averaging 11 miles per gallon.
Wow.
Really?
11.
Yes. Yeah, Tommy, I would agree with you. The CTSV wagon is just a home run. It's such a shame that it didn't stick around.
They did it with an automatic and a manual. And I was reading somewhere that the production numbers on the manual were like, they built 500 of them.
Yeah, that's about right.
Tiny number.
Yeah, it's minuscule. For GM, that's absolutely tiny. But bear in mind that, you know, almost every automotive journalist who drove one of these absolutely lauded it, and for good reason.
Yeah, 6.2 liter supercharged V8, as we discussed.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know if underappreciated is the right word. I'm just looking at, like, Bring a Trailer, the prices. Huh? One sold a few days ago, $58,000 with 104,000 miles.
Did you say 58,000?
Yeah, and they were probably, what, 65, 70?
Yeah, give or take, yeah. Oh, yeah, wow.
Apparently, they didn't depreciate much.
No, good for Cadillac. And they held together. And you know what? I mean, you really have a solid running gear with that vehicle, too. Good brakes, even though it was pretty heavy. I think they weighed like 5,000 pounds or something like that.
So remember in this era, they had the wagon, they had the sedan, and then they had that like funky coupe.
Yes, I do.
Which one would you get?
No, the wagon.
The wagon.
Even, you know, I don't really have kids to you know, they can do it on their own, and I really don't need a wagon, but I like a wagon.
Yeah.
And it just, what a great car that is. And it's so under the, unless you really know what you're looking at, you wouldn't know what you're looking at.
And that's why I think it's underappreciated, right? Like, you really have to be in the car community to kind of understand what the significance of the CTSV wagon
is. I'm curious if you'll bring up its distant competitor later on.
All right. So I've got one more Cadillac. And so I think we agree on the CTSV. I'm not sure you're going to agree with me on this one. This was...
Don't say the ELR.
It's the ELR.
Damn it, no. God, you and your dad with your crazy desires, and I don't understand it.
It's the ELR. So this was a weird thing. So remember the Chevy Volt, which was a plug-in hybrid?
I do indeed.
They took the Volt, they chopped off the back doors, they give it some insane styling, doors that were seriously longer than like the state of Nebraska.
Yeah, they're some of the largest doors in its, not only the segment, but out there, period, for a two-door. It's ridiculous.
Insanely long doors, and then they slapped a price tag of like 90 grand on this.
Ridiculous. Yeah. But they didn't change the powertrain. I mean, essentially, it was the same powertrain. So essentially, what you were getting is a two-door Chevy Bolt with a nicer interior. I got to admit, actually pretty decent looking on the outside. They styled it nicely.
It was very cool looking.
Yeah, it was unique. You know, this is around the same time that Cadillac brought in temporarily a new, I don't know if it was a president or a president of PR, who said Cadillac's no longer building cars, we're building products.
Okay.
And that was like the worst possible thing you could say to car people. Because it's exactly the opposite. Cadillac is supposed to be one of the premier American, you know, coach builders and whatnot. So this car came out, and I went to not the actual event, but like a premiere. So, you know, I pulled the thing off. And at first I'm like, oh, hey, this is a really good looking car. Look at those big doors. It's like an old T-Bird. And I started asking him about, you know, okay, so would you guys supercharge it or something like that? Because I know it's got, you know, Chevy Volt. Yep. No, we didn't supercharge it. so it's got an extra electric motor in the back? No, it doesn't have it. It's, bigger battery? No, it doesn't. It's like, what the hell? So I was really losing my cool. And I'm like, all right, fine. Did your dad actually drive one?
Yeah, we've actually reviewed it a few times. We had one in Florida.
Perfect place for it.
Yeah, but I love the design. I mean, you're right. From a tech and kind of performance standpoint, I think it had 230 horsepower for like 70 grand.
Yeah.
Only 39 miles of range, but it looked like the future. It had a beautiful interior. And you remember it got to the point where, like, I think it was discontinued sometime around 2016. And I mean, dealers could not sell him. They like, one of our buddies in the industry, you know, Tom Volk with Driven Car
Review. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I think
yeah, of course.
He bought one new and he got like, $35,000 off sticker because they just like the dealer was like, I don't know what to do with this.
Oh, the good old days. Nowadays, if you still had one on your lot, you could sell it for 200 grand. Someone would buy it. So I get it what you're saying in terms of the physical design of the vehicle, but the point is that in terms of name badge swapping and the fact that underneath it is essentially a $35,000 car.
Yeah.
I absolutely disagree. No way.
Nowadays, it's like a $25,000 car. So all right. So I got a yes on the CTS-V, a no on the ELR.
Yeah, no on the ELR.
All right. So you're probably going to have a similar reaction to our next brand, Chevrolet. Mm-hmm. First up is the SS.
Wow. So SS, I actually went to that event when they had the SS Turbo.
Well, I'm thinking SS as in, I think you drove this one too, but the 6.2 liter V8 sedan.
Oh, you're talking about that SS.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about the panel wagon.
Oh, no, not the HHR.
HHR. I don't know why I was thinking SS with that, because the SS is the
No, this was
version
this was
it,
yeah. a Holden Commodore in Australia.
You know, for one thing, real shame that Chevrolet completely fell out of love with that vehicle right when it was introduced in the United States, because it essentially was the spiritual successor for the actual Impala with rear drive.
Yeah, I think that's
a
good
proper
way to look at it. Yeah.
Powertrain. We drove a few of them. They were really good, like really solid.
415 horsepower?
Yeah, really? I mean, plenty of power, really good handling, kind of like a big BMW, kind of 5 Series-ish, but at the same time, you know, not the most sophisticated interior, but there was nothing wrong with it. It would have been fine for most Americans, but how many commercials did you see with that, or how many banners or anything else? Chevrolet absolutely did not want to spend a dime on getting the word out on this vehicle. No advertising whatsoever. And that was an issue. And then the other issue was Pontiac G8. And I don't know if that's on your list or not.
No, it isn't, but that's a good one.
So that was its cousin. And they had the GXP version. And that GXP was a dream car. It was fabulous. It was also the only vehicle you could get in that class that had the manual transmission in terms of Pontiac. And it was just a beast. And it was also based on a Holden platform. And unfortunately, it just didn't sell. And it just, the timing was all wrong. And not to mention the fact that Pontiac shortly thereafter fell off the face of the earth. So it was a real shame. So this vehicle, it's kind of a sad song.
Yeah.
I've seen people selling them for stupid money.
Okay.
Because they're so rare. And then I've also seen police departments take the lesser versions of those and actually make them into police vehicles.
Yeah, because there was that police only. It was like the Caprice PPV, or they had some funny name for it.
But it essentially was the same vehicle, but just it wasn't with the big engine. And it was fairly good, but it didn't have the flexible platform that like the equivalent Dodge or whatever would have, because as far as I know, there was never an all-wheel drive version of them. At least here in the States, there was never a wagon version. They had a ute version overseas. We never got that.
Yeah,
so,
true.
You know, it was kind of, I agree with you in terms of it's something that, how do I put it? It was a shame. That's it. It was a shame. It never lived up to its potential, not because it didn't have potential, but because its owners didn't feel like it had the potential.
I think it was also just confusing in the U.S. because we had like the Camaro, which mm-hmm. everybody knew. We had the Corvette, which everybody knew. And then there was this own standalone model, which was like an imported Australian car. With.
But they hid
name.
It in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
And so you never really knew what it was. If they said it was a four-door Camaro, you know, had they styled it a little bit more aggressively, it was kind of boring to look at. That would have helped too. But I do agree with you that it's something, it's kind of rare. And it's one of those things that may be a collector's car in the future.
I think you're right. So you agree with me on
yes.
the SS.
Yes.
Next
SS.
Up, Chevrolet, I don't think you're going to agree with me on, but I think the Volt, the very first Volt, was a very revolutionary car. Believe it or not, if you look at the reliability reports on the first-gen Volt, the batteries are extremely long-lived.
Mm-hmm.
This was, of course, Bob Lutz's baby. This was like his ultimate dream for America, was to have a car that could go about 40 miles on a charge and then still have a gas engine for when you ran out of battery. But I thought the first-gen Volt was cool-looking. It had a crazy interior with this white floating center instrument cluster and pretty undervalued.
I can't agree with you, really.
All right.
I don't dislike the car. Bear in mind, my brother has a second generation Volt, and it was a pretty interesting car.
Hmm.
Still is. They're still driving the hell out of it, and it does well. It's actually fairly reliable, but there are little glitches here and there. One of the issues I have is the design of it. The original Volt was really built for four people.
Right.
They kind of sort of had this little center component where a butt could fit, but the human cannot. It didn't have a lot of cargo capacity. It was supposed to be all things to all people. I drove one up and over the pass, and I was going towards Glenwood Springs, and it did not like driving up and over the hills. Once it started running out of juice and it was having to rely on its gas engine, it did not enjoy going over those hills. It lost a lot of power. The performance was never the particularly good, but the second generation did a much better job going up and over the hills, and it was better power management. So it's a good car, but it's honestly one that they should have continuously improved on. The fact that it's gone is a real issue, because I do think that hybrids have a place in society and should remain. But General Motors apparently doesn't think so.
I just thought it was, I mean, it was pretty ahead of its time. It should have been the car that everybody wanted, because, I mean, it would save you so much money over the long run for just commuting, right? 30 miles doesn't sound like a lot, whatever it was, 35. But I think for most people, that would be plenty for a lot of folks' commutes. I do agree that, I mean, yeah, practicality-wise, it was not great. The four-seater was a bad call. But I do think that they are worth considering now as a used vehicle. So I got a yes on the SS, a no on the Volt.
A no on the Volt. It's a good car, though. Don't get me wrong. It's just I don't really think it really belongs on this list.
All right.
So there it is.
Next up, going to Chrysler, I've got the 300 SRT8.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because I was wondering if you're going to mention one of its cousins. Your dad and I went and drove one on the track, and it's kind of a pig, but it's a lovable pig. It's so friend heavy, and it's just a really big heavy car with a really big heavy engine that can move, but it really doesn't like going around corners. It wasn't much of a luxury car, but man, is it a gangster car.
Yeah, so they did two, right? They did the first one and the second one, and I think the first one was a really cool one.
I agree. The first one had a little bit more street cred. It had a little bit more presence.
Yeah, it was just very square.
Yeah.
Big wheels for the era. 6.1 liter V8. It was kind of like right when they launched the rebirth, the Challenger too. Remember the SRT8 Challenger, same kind of era. So love the 300 SRT8. I think they're highly undervalued in today's market. The second gen was okay too.
Yeah, the second gen was refined by comparison. It was in fact, that's the one that your dad and I went and drove. It was great in terms of very comfortable. That was right when they introduced the Beats sound system. Remember that whole thing?
I do remember
Dr.
that.
Dr. Dre and all. Yeah, so, and it had, you know, it was loud. So it was this loud kind of bolsters car that felt good because everything was comfy. And at the same time, and it had a pretty decent ride, but it just didn't handle great.
Oh, it was not a handling machine.
So the first generation was a little bit rough around the edges, but it still has a lot of street, you know, it sounds cool, and it just kind of looks cool. So I will agree with you on the first generation, but I will not agree on the second generation.
All right, I'll take that. I think that the second gen was also, I mean, but the issue with the second gen is they tried to like put a focus on handling. I'm like, this is a sedan that weighs more than a small moon. Like, why are you?
Exactly. And just it's just the tires weren't wide enough. Line. The suspension, it's just like you could only do so much with that, you know, and we've seen that before with SUVs, and this essentially is the weight of an SUV that they put all the power into the rear wheels.
It was massive. Yeah, huge. But now they're pretty cheap. You can get one for like 10 to 15 grand, and lots of fun for a small amount of money.
And those big V8s are actually relatively reliable.
6.1s were good, but they get I'm just looking right now on like Facebook Marketplace. Mm-hmm. They have fallen into the hands of folks that probably modded them in less than tasteful ways.
Oh, you think so? Were they slammed? Were they dropped to the ground?
All of it. Lots of red accents everywhere.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of that. And it's typical. And any vehicle that'll happen to.
So same kind of vein. What do you think of this one? The Dodge Magnum.
I was hoping you were going to say that one. When you mentioned the CTSV wagon, the first thing that comes to my mind is the Magnum, because it really is the only competitor in the American market, right? So the thing is...
Well, what was it? Can you explain what it was?
The Dodge Magnum essentially is the same platform as what we just talked about, the Chrysler...
The Charger.
The Charger, the Challenger, which is all based on an older Mercedes-Benz E platform from a gazillion years ago, the same hard points and whatnot. But what happened was Ralph Yales came along and designed this vehicle, made it look very aggressive. It is a wagon, and it, at one point in time, they advertised it as a wagon that was faster than Lamborghini.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And it's an unusual wagon because the way the hatch is designed, it goes way back, and so the hinge is nearly midship on the thing. So when you open it, it opens huge. And it gives you a lot of space. It's not as subdued looking as the Cadillac CTSV.
Yeah.
But you could get that big Hemi in there. Mm-hmm. I believe that they made a few all-wheel drive versions, but I don't know if they were able to squeeze the big Hemi with all-wheel drive
maybe or the 5.7.
Maybe it was the 5.7. I drove the big one, and it was a hoot. It's a ridiculously fun vehicle. Very, very good for utility, kind of like the Cadillac. Cadillac is a lot more refined, handled way better. The Cadillac absolutely outhandled it. But in terms of just a fun vehicle, man, those Magnums were fun and really practical, just really crap mileage.
Surprisingly expensive now, the SRTs. I think they made so few of the SRT wagons and the Magnums. All the Magnums are wagons, but like you see the SRT Chargers, you see the Jeeps, you see the Chryslers, but the Magnums were really rare. So those are expensive. And one thing about all these cars from like the early 2010s and mid 2000s Chrysler is the interiors are so bad.
Yes, I will agree. You know, there was a lot of like plasticky stuff going on with the interiors, and it went all throughout. This is before they brought in Hans, and essentially, he's one of these guys who just magically sprinkled fairy dust and made these interiors so much better. And now, FCA, now Stellantis, has some of the best interiors out there in terms of feel, quality, and look and design. And that was partially because of this guy and some others. And the point is that this was predating this guy.
Yeah.
And so they were very cheap and chintzy looking, and you could find components right off of the minivans and all that inside these cars.
Yeah, they were pretty badly made on the insides.
Now, Tommy, before we move on, I do recommend that you refire your retina scan so it will fire up on the screen behind
you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, there it goes.
The screen is falling asleep.
Yeah.
And before we continue, I wanted to bring up something kind of interesting.
Yes.
So I like to do these this date in history, and today is January 10th. If you're listening to the podcast, you caught it early. Did you know in January 10th, in 1942, so what is that, 80 years ago today?
It was your dad's high school. Okay.
Ford signed an agreement to produce 280,000
Jeeps,
exactly, for World War II. They called them the GPWs, which stood for General Purpose Willys, because ultimately Willys was awarded the first contract to build the military Jeeps. But not a lot of people know that almost 300,000 of the World War II Jeeps were not made by Willys, but made by Ford.
They had a different designation, too. There was like an F somewhere, and some like maybe in their tag or something.
I think it was, so GP was like General Purpose, and then the W stood for Willys on the Fords. And the Fords are actually interesting. They're worth typically more than the Willys, or... because I'm going to get the comments and people say Willis. But if you look at like the bolt heads on the Fords, they all have the Ford script in them, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. So I didn't know that. That one part I didn't know.
That's how you distinguish them, yeah.
Yes. Now, to throw more fuel on that fire, Ford and Jeep have sort of reignited the whole love of proper off-road 4x4 vehicles. Just this year.
Yeah.
I mean, just this past year, I should say, with the new Bronco coming out and going directly against the Jeep Wrangler. I absolutely love the fact that this is happening. I think you guys do, too.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So after the war, of course, they continued making essentially the same design. Willys or Willis, produced it under the name CJ, which stood for Civilian Jeep, mm-hmm. and then that became the CJ2, the CJ2A, and then the 3, the 5, the 7, and then the Wrangler.
Wrangler.
And now we've got Wrangler versus Bronco, and we're back in the action.
Are we in like the 7th generation of Wrangler, technically, or 6th generation?
It was YJ first, TJ, JK, JL, 4th of Wrangler.
Fourth, okay.
Of the name Wrangler.
Yeah, and so this, and it's just going to get better. I'm really excited about this. I love off-roading, and so this, the idea of more people coming to play is better for the consumer. So yep. Let's continue. Speaking of consumers, and let's find out what other turkeys he's fried up here.
So this one was one, I don't know if I agree with this, but my dad wanted this on this list. And I think you drove this car, and it only sold in 2 markets. It's made by Ford, and it is the Flex. Do you remember the Flex? It was like
a, of course I remember
like
the Flex.
A beach-going
actually,
SUV thing.
The very first video your dad and I did together as a collaboration. This is back when I was working for V Hicks and some other, you know,
V Hicks.
Yeah, they're gone. Back. Anyway, your dad and I got together right when they introduced the Ford Flex. That was one of the first EcoBoost examples out there. And it was a rocket. I mean, it was really, really fast. We were really surprised by it. And they actually had an event up here in Colorado. And that's where your dad and I went and drove one around, did a little video on it, I think. And there's good and bad. Ford Flex is essentially the same platform that you have in, at the time, the Ford Taurus and also the Ford Explorer. They all had this front-wheel drive bias design. It was all same or very similar platform. And the Flex, the whole purpose of it was sort of to come up with a wagon that could basically do what a crossover SUV does, but with a low roof line kind of looking cool. That was their point.
Okay. That's interesting.
And they failed.
They failed.
Yeah, I really disliked the design because it wasn't as utilitarian as say the it was even more expensive at one point in time than the equivalent Ford you know, SUV. So it didn't make a lot of sense to me there. And then in terms of handling, it didn't handle that great either. It was okay. It was off the line, it was quick, but it just didn't corner very well. And to me it was like, okay, so the Taurus X, which predated it, and then the 500 and what they called it, they had another name for the Taurus.
The Freestyle?
Wagon. Yeah, Freestyle, that was it. Yeah. So they had these that kind of predated it. And those, I get it, they were kind of like, well, this is a wagon, but it kind of looks like a crossover. We'll call it a crossover. Nope. They didn't even bother calling the Flex a wagon. They just said it was this multi-utility machine or whatever. It just, if you look at them, they have a very low roof line. And for the price and for what it was, and also the fact that it had a really low ground clearance. And I got stuck really bad in the snow driving one of those around. And then I drove its Lincoln brother, and I got even more stuck in one of those, too, in the snow. They were just too low to the ground. So I'm not a big fan of them, personally, and I honestly don't think much of them.
What about like the surf-going design with that, you know, very long, kind of low look, the panel van almost design?
Had they actually put wood panel on the side, I might have actually fallen in love with it. They had the white roof, so they were like halfway there. But it seems like a committee came in halfway through the design and said, we got to stop. The interior was remarkably boring.
It was pretty boring inside. Lots of room in the third row, if I remember right.
But not great headroom. It was like a wagon, but a low wagon.
They did have these kind of like cool slits along the side.
Yeah.
And I actually had an interesting conversation. Apparently, Ford only sold these in 2 markets, and the 2 markets they sold extremely well in and didn't sell anywhere else was Detroit and Los Angeles. It was the only 2 places people bought Flexes.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
And actually, I do know somebody in Los Angeles who bought one against my advice, and she promptly detonated the engine. Her fault, I think.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You know, it's a fair. So one of the benefits of having a station wagon is that you have a low roof, so you have access to the roof, and also you don't have to climb up into it, which is great.
Oh yeah.
So those are benefits. The negative parts are if you're actually buying something, because it did have all-wheel drive, I believe, as an option all the way through its life, the vehicle just did terribly on even mildly rough roads because it just didn't have the ground clearance. So it made more sense to get an Explorer, which essentially was the same vehicle.
They built them for a long time, so 2009 through 2019 model years. Assembled in Ontario, Canada, which is
yeah, and very little change, I believe, throughout the entire run. They may have had a different engine, like the updated.
Yeah, they didn't EcoBoost. Launch with the EcoBoost, but then they got the EcoBoost eventually. I think is how that worked.
Yeah, and I think actually there were a couple. Anyway, the point is that I really didn't think much of that vehicle, and I don't really think of it as something that really should be aimed for.
Okay, so that's a no-go.
That's a no, sorry.
All right, next up, and I think that this one is going to be agreed upon. I just have the word, the Genesis brand, and then all the cars, underappreciated.
Wow, yeah, yeah. That's, it's, you know, there's a very interesting thing. A lot of people don't realize that Genesis could have happened a lot earlier than it did and should have probably. A long time ago, Hyundai did bring in the Equus into the United States. And the Equus was this fantastic, big sedan, luxury vehicle. The exterior was ugly, simply put. It was just ugly.
It was ugly.
But essentially, it was sort of the first Genesis, because it was the first time that Hyundai attempted to show what they could do in terms of engineering and luxury selling here in the United States. And the car didn't sell. I don't know how many they sold, but it wasn't very many. And they only brought in a few. But I think it started getting some people into the idea that Hyundai could do a lot more. And then a little bit later on, they brought out their Genesis. Now, it was just still a Hyundai Genesis as opposed to the name itself. And that should have been its own brand. I think that in time, one of the things that's happened with Genesis is that they brought in every single half-decent, if not extraordinary, designer, right?
Yeah.
And engineer out of European firms and some Asian firms as well, and stuck them in with probably a damn fat envelope of cash into the Hyundai family and built Genesis. That's how they should have done it in the first place. They had the cash to do it. They waited, I think, a little too long, but they followed some of the recipe that Lexus did with Toyota. And now they're winning awards left and right, and for a damn good reason. They build amazing cars.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I actually had the Hyundai Genesis on here too, which was the first launch. A fantastic car, right?
Yeah, it was great.
It was like 90% of like a 3 Series or a 5 Series mm-hmm. for 60% of the price. Fantastic. You get it with a 5-liter V8. Love the Hyundai Genesis. I like the coupe even. Remember
the Hyundai coupe? Yeah, the Genesis coupe was a funny thing because you could get it in a couple different flavors.
Yeah, it was like a V6, there's a 4-cylinder turbo, right. There's a manual.
Your dad and I had one that we did an early video on, and man, that thing really needed the limited slip rear diff because we just roasted the right rear tire or something like that. It was crazy. But for a driver, actually it was a pretty good driver's car, and it was a really good alternative to, at the time, the 370, well, actually 350, and then later the 370Z, and it kind of filtered in that whole era because it really did compete with it. I would say that Hyundai should have kept something like that, and now you're seeing sort of the revision of it now with the whole N thing coming up. Could you imagine one of those surviving and becoming an N?
Yeah, like, that would have been cool.
Beast.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've heard that the current head of like the N program, Albert Biermann, who came from the BMW M division.
Right.
I've heard that he hated the Genesis Coupe. Like, it hated it.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a fun car, manual transmission. And then when you look at the full Genesis line, I've only driven, I think, two, the GV80, which is like the X5 competitor.
Yes.
And then the G90, which is the 7
I thought
series.
You drove the GV70 too.
I wasn't here for that. I think I drove that.
You missed out.
But I heard that thing was amazing. And I think it was a good idea for them to break it off as its own brand.
I agree 100%.
People weren't going to spend $70,000 next to someone buying an Elantra.
Yeah.
But I still think that they're insanely underappreciated cars.
They are underappreciated. One of the problems they're also having is that brand recognition, because they don't really have dealerships. It's a whole long story about everything going online and everything else. And I agree that you can't have one of those on the same dealership lot as a Hyundai Accent. You can't.
Yeah, and it's like, it's frustrating. I mean, there's a Genesis dealer somewhere in Denver, mm-hmm. but it's so far away that I don't know if I could realistically bite the bullet and buy one compared to like a Lexus, which has three dealers super close to us.
Right.
So that's a tricky thing.
Over time, they will expand. I mean, they are getting accolades for their build quality and for their design and performance, and rightfully so. So hopefully they'll be able to start injecting more money into the dealerships and perhaps have more service dealerships that are available, and they are going to be moving to a lot of electric vehicles in the near future. I think they may beat Lexus to the punch on that. They're being very smart about their design, and I've loved every one I've driven. Yeah, there's been minor details, like some of the back seats aren't very big in my case, or perhaps the trunk's a little small, or maybe the design, like certain steering wheels I don't like, but they're all really minor issues with what is an outstanding car.
I agree. Yeah, completely.
Okay.
So moving on from Genesis to Honda, we'll see if you agree with on this one. I thought this was a cool car, all-wheel drive. It was a little weird to look at, but pretty usable for what it was, the Honda Crosstour.
Oh, no, no.
I
thought you were going to say Element. And I was going to be like, oh, yeah, Element, yay. You're such a great kid. No, damn it.
The Cross Tour?
No,
really?
No,
don't
God.
Like the Cross Tour?
Well, the Cross Tour, for one thing, it was based on very similar bones to the ZDX, which I also abhor. And the thing is that the roof line was terrible. Another thing that was very interesting about that vehicle, it looks really big, and it actually is a fairly sizable vehicle on the outside. But unlike everything else Honda does, where they do such magnificent things with packaging, right, and room, this had the opposite. So when you open the trunk, you have these two massive sections where the towers for the suspension protrude directly into the cargo area. And so when you want to put a bike or something like that in there, you have to kind of go around these things. And it takes the utility and drops it down a notch. You actually have more usable space, that is, inside a Honda Fit. Oh, I kid you not.
Wow, that's a bold move.
No, I'm quite serious about that. We did a video 4 years ago, 3 years ago, where we put a bunch of tires inside a Honda Fit, and hence they fit, with two drivers, a driver and a passenger. I'm pretty sure that it would be almost equal to the Honda that you mentioned that I don't want to talk about.
Well, I mean,
it's like Voldemort among Hondas.
It's related to the Accord, which is a good platform. It's got a pretty strong V6. The 3.5 V6 was pretty good. They had like pre-facelift and post-facelift. A little, I do think you're right. I mean, it wasn't like a wagon, right? It didn't have the usability of a wagon.
No.
But it. Did you think it looks cool?
No.
Not at all.
No. The funny thing is that they lifted it. And you'd think, oh, okay, I think it had almost around 9 inches of ground clearance, or eight and a half.
For what it was.
But the overhangs up front and the back were horrible. So I took one of those off-road. I was going to take it up to Left Hand Canyon. We were still using that at the time when we were using this car. I didn't have the time to make it up there, so I went to a different place where they had some minor little lifts, you know, some ruts. And I kept just bottoming out in the front end. And then finally, like, the departure angle was dreadful. And it's like, this is not a vehicle that you should be taking off road at all. But then I also noticed that sight lines were really poor, and that's the design of the vehicle. Same with the ZDX.
Wow, you really don't like this.
No, I didn't like it at all. I didn't like it because I knew Honda could do better. And, you know, driving around Elements, which are just really weird, funky, cool vehicles.
So would you put the Element on?
Hell yeah, I love the Element. The Element was just so cool. It had problems too. It really needed more ground clearance, and it would have been nice to have a seat so three people could go in the back as opposed to just two. But a buddy of mine put his 600cc motorcycle inside of one.
God.
Yeah, we actually drove it quite a distance, and it was fine. Dog kennels fit in there. You could wash out the floor. Just a smart, really weird, funky design. I really think Honda was onto something with that. But in terms of...
All right, hard no on the Cross Tour here.
Yeah, Cross Tour is no bueno.
Now, the reason I didn't put the Element on the list is because I forgot it existed. So that's why that isn't on the list.
And they actually sold okay for a while. And you could get a manual with those, too. Really rare.
The first Element was really cool with like the black plastic mold.
Yeah, I agree.
It was really cool. I didn't think that the second one was as neat.
I didn't like the painted panels either, frankly. It was an interesting car. It's one that I would own one if I had a reason to have a funky, weird car. And you know, the seating position was really good in those.
Oh,
really, really good. Yeah, it was like sitting at home on a sofa, very upright. It was cool.
All right, so I will give you the Element. I think that's a better choice. Moving on from H to J. So we talked about Hyundai, the Genesis. I think, and this is actually a current car, one of the few current cars on the list, the Jaguar I-Pace, the electric Jaguar, is a really cool car that nobody buys. I understand why they don't buy it because it's really expensive, mm-hmm. and the range isn't as good as like a Tesla.
Yeah.
But really a very cool piece of engineering, decently quick. It looks very neat. It's okay off-road. My dad actually took it off-road.
Yeah.
I like the I-Pace a lot.
I agree with you 100%.
Wow.
That I only drove one once, and it was a pretty limited drive. And had Jaguar figured out a way to add another, say, 20 miles, 30 miles,
yeah.
to really make it much more competitive, I think it would have sold a lot more. It's a really compelling car. And here's the funny thing about it. You know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, it's an electric vehicle and it's British? The whole thing about British electric? Come on, dude, you own like 19 British cars.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a little scary. But the other side of it is the tech itself is solid. So far, I haven't heard of any major issues with those vehicles either. And I really do believe that they are truly undervalued. And it's a shame because I think that they handle great.
Oh, yeah.
And they have some presence.
They do. I think they look cool.
There are so many Teslas on the ground. They all remind me of like electric shavers or whatever.
And granted, like $80,000, a lot of money. But at least before the market blew up, there were huge discounts on them.
Yes.
Dealers were really working to move them.
Yes, they were.
So you could get really good deals on them. And I just love them. I think they're really cool.
Had they just had like a solid 300-mile range.
I know.
Range,
with the two,
you know what I mean?
Whatever, 250 or whatever it was,
just,
240.
Just a little bit more range would have made those things sell like hotcakes, I think.
And well, they needed to charge a little faster too.
Yeah, yeah. There was a 7 or no? Well, it doesn't matter.
It was, okay. Okay, next Jaguar. I think you're not going to agree with me on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Highly underrated Jaguar. I would say the most underrated Jaguar.
Oh, no,
oh,
you're
yes.
not.
Oh, yes.
No, not, your dad had one, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God, here we go.
Fantastic car, the Jaguar X-Type.
You mean the Ford Mondeo?
Yes, I get it. It's a Ford Mondeo. That's true.
It's a Ford Mondeo.
But fantastic interior, lots of leather. I mean, lots and lots of leather. It had Ford reliability, which doesn't sound like much, but compared to Jaguar at the time, that was a great thing. Standard all-wheel drive. Manual transmission. They did it in a wagon. What is
the
not
wagon
like?
The wagon version I might be tempted on.
they built like 30 of them.
Yeah, none of them. There's like two
looking.
That were sold in the States. No, I'm sorry.
What's wrong with the X-Type?
I can't. How do I put it? It's not even a question of badge engineering and whatnot. It really is a sheep in wolf's clothing.
Sheep in wolf's clothing.
It's exactly the opposite of what I consider a Jaguar. When I want British engineering, I want British engineering. That means that straight six, a V6, I don't care what it is. I want it to come out of Coventry or something like that. I want it to come out of a British place, and they put it into a British car. When they basically are taking a German European Ford and making it look a lot like a Jaguar, I'll give them credit. It's not. It's not.
They did definitely go crazy with the it's got the quad headlights, right? Very.
It looks like a Jaguar, and I give them all the credit. When I first saw it, before I knew what it was, I was going crazy. This is when did those come out? Those came out like in
2003 or something.
2003?
Yeah,
thought it was even earlier.
It was pretty early, maybe 2002.
Yeah.
The X-Type, though, right, it was based on the Mondeo, and everyone always got Mondeo underneath.
Yeah.
But the, like, it was European Mondeo, which was better than like our Fusion, right? It was a fun car to drive,
I guess. Okay. I did drive one.
2001. You're right.
Yeah. Okay, so, and I didn't hate it. I wasn't really comfortable. I'm surprised your dad found them comfortable. I really didn't like the way the leg room was set up and all that. And it was a little bit short for me too. But it's just not, when you know it's really fake, I mean, it is really fake. When you know how fake it truly is, it kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And I cannot recommend a car like that because I would rather recommend an actual Jaguar. Yes, that runs like crap, but it has a proper Jaguar feel to it.
I distinctly remember my dad bought one in like 2004, so I was like 7 years old. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the dealer. I was really into cars when I was 7. I'm very excited. It was bright red. And I distinctly remember, and I still think that my memory is right, if you wanted the sport trim,
mm-hmm.
which got you the manual transmission. It got you the manual transmission. They blacked out all the chrome, so it had a cool look. But you could only get the sport trim in the smaller 2.5
yes.
liter engine.
Yes,
and that was a really stupid idea.
And I wondered about that, and I got an answer, not from an official Ford guy, but like an inside Ford guy.
Okay.
And the reason why was to make sure that vehicle maintained reliability. That was one of the issues that they wanted to do with this, because the reliability index of Jaguar when Ford came along was abysmal. It was one of the worst in the industry, and Ford lifted them up.
Oh, yeah.
But by putting the less powerful powertrain in there with the manual transmission, you were able to make it last a little bit longer. The clutch would last longer. Everything would last a little bit longer. Now, this is just what was told to me, not from an official Ford person. It makes a little bit of sense, but it was also really anemic. I mean, without...
Yeah, it was like 190 horsepower.
It wasn't enough. That car was really heavy.
So, no on the X-Type?
No, I'm sorry. I know your dad's going to be like trying to get a flight back here now. How dare you? But I really... It felt like such a fake. It was an impersonator.
I-Pace? Good on the I-Pace?
Yes, I'm great on the I-Pace. The I-Pace, and that's a Jaguar. I know a lot of European and Asian engineering underneath, actually, from a variety of different companies. But it feels like a Jaguar, and it is a Jaguar.
So about 15 minutes left. I've got a few more we're going to crank through.
Yes.
Starting with Kia, the K900 and the Cadenza. Remember the K900 and the Cadenza? So this was Kia's attempt at a luxury car. Very, very luxurious. They didn't, I mean, at one point I saw the K900 sales numbers like in triple digits, like under a few hundred.
Yeah, like 250 or something.
Yeah,
like
it was really, really bad. Weird choice to even bring it over.
But well, it was really a bad name.
The K900. In Korea, it was called the K9. But for the American market, they were worried about the dog connection. So they had
a bunch of nasty stuff about that. You know, it's a funny thing. I've driven both. And I actually went to the Cadenza event when they actually updated it. It's a great car.
Fantastic.
A really, really good car.
Very comfy.
Very comfortable on the inside. Handled fine. It was nothing special. The K900 is actually a little bit special. Had a really big back seat. Had a very comfortable ride to it. In fact, I think they had a LeBron James commercial with that thing.
Did they?
Yeah. And all of that went away when they brought out the Stinger, which is another really underrated car. But
That would have been a good one too.
Yeah. I would have voted for that. I will not vote for the K900 because it just didn't have a place in the United States.
Okay.
But I will vote for the Cadenza because the Cadenza is one of those cars that really nobody paid attention to, and I think a lot of people who went out and bought for the equivalent price a American and or Japanese vehicle or a really cheap version of a German vehicle, they could have had all the luxury they wanted, all the amenities they wanted in a fairly reliable package that had a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty.
K900 was just crazy because it was like massive, huge.
It's a big car.
It was monstrous, yeah. And I thought it was, nowadays, I'm sure you could find them if you could get one, for pretty cheap, quite reliable. So I put both of those on the list. So no on the K900, yes on the Cadenza.
Yeah.
Straight on to Land Rover. This is an interesting one.
Okay.
Mid-2000s LR2. Remember the little one that's kind of like the Escape? These, by the way, this is interesting. If you look at like used Land Rover prices, obviously they're just right in the toilet, right? Like an LR3 was like a $6,000 car nowadays. But an LR2, for some reason, like a $9,000 or $10,000 car. People love the little, based on like the Escape,
I think.
Yeah,
I was about to say, didn't it have some components from the Escape?
It had essentially an EcoBoost. Yeah, but people love the LR2s.
Yeah, they were okay. I had one. I didn't fit very well in it. I remember that, you know, and I'm not that big, but I just wasn't that comfortable in it. Didn't like the way it performed. I liked the way it looked. I thought it was a really good looking vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, no low range, but it had like terrain modes for off-road. It had nice leather seats. It had a little screen in it, which was pretty cool. I think they're good looking cars, reasonably off-roady, and just overall pretty good little design.
You know what sucks?
What?
I could get a Subaru Forester and completely outperform it in almost every conceivable
way. Yeah, but it's not a Land Rover. It doesn't have a turbo engine and the mystique of the British brand.
I will give it that, but I wouldn't choose it at all. I would stay away from that.
Nathan.
There are other Land Rover products I would take way over that.
The other thing about the LR2s is they did have some turbo issues, but they were, for the most part, as you look at mid-2000s, early 2010 Land Rovers, quite reliable.
Did they replace the Freelander, Freeloader?
Yes. The Freelander was a garbage pile with the LR2. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And they did have convertible version of the Freeloader.
The Freelander. Yes. Yes, they did do a convertible Freelander. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a no-go on the LR2.
No.
Lexus CT200H. Remember the little hatchback?
Okay.
Hybrid.
I'm glad you mentioned that one and not the other one that will remain unnamed.
The HF.
Huh?
That thing was a pop.
I was worried that you were going to say that. Yes. Oh, absolutely. I loved that little CT. The CT was interesting because it was actually based on the Toyota TC/Scion TC platform. And it was a very fun car to drive that had no horsepower.
Yes, it was slow.
It was very slow, but it handled well, and it was also the first Lexus to bring back red for many, many, many years, because they actually got rid of red.
Oh, yeah?
And that was one of the first, I remember that was like they sent us a whole pamphlet
on it. In the CT?
Oh. Yep, on the CT.
They had like this crazy yellow. Do you remember the yellow
one? Yes, they had a bright yellow.
Yeah.
That was right before they phased them out, and they were on a really old platform, and essentially, you know, Prius running gear, you know, underneath.
Essentially. I think that you're right in that what they were going for was like a sporty little hatchback, but then they made it a hybrid. It was like the Honda CRZ issue where like you're trying to promote the sportiness and then it's like, but it's got a hybrid powertrain with 200 horsepower, whatever.
But I guarantee you they're still on the road and they're still running really good unless they've been crunched, you know, in terms of accidents. Not that you're going to get in many with the car that slow.
Sorry, 134 horsepower.
Yeah, it needed another 100 really to make it look as fast as it looked, to make it perform as fast as it looked.
But
because they looked quick, didn't they?
Yeah, insanely. extremely reliable. Very reliable, very well made, pretty comfortable.
Very small interior.
Very small interior.
But I will, straight off the bat, I'm going to agree with you. That is a very interesting car. Its cousin, no.
The HF was,
no, yeah, we can't even mention that here.
Okay, right. Well, we'll move on from the CT to a car you owned.
Oh, no. Well, I've owned a lot of cars.
Oh, you've owned a lot of cars. So but I thought this thing was cool. One of the only vehicles in its class with a manual transmission, the Mazda 5.
The Mazda 5 is an interesting vehicle, one that I'm not going to necessarily agree with.
Though. Really? Yeah. A manual transmission minivan and you're not going to agree
it
with
it? It is
me?
The only manual transmission minivan that was built and sold here in the United States for years and years. There were some other ones prior to that, but essentially this vehicle wasn't really a minivan. It was essentially a large hatchback with sliding doors that had a third row, a tiny third row, but it was a Mazda 3 underneath. Right. And it was a little underpowered. They kind of tried to play it off as like a multi-purpose vehicle and say that it could actually be something in the snow. Look, I live in snow country. That thing wasn't brilliant in snow. It was okay. It was very low to the ground. They were really good utility vehicles, or utilitarian, I should say. In that respect, very good, great vehicle in that respect. But in terms of it being a vehicle worthy of a 5-speed manual or a 6-speed, I think, later on. No.
Really?
They were so slow.
Wasn't it fun to drive, though? Wasn't it, handle well?
Not really. It was kind of like driving a heavy Mazda 3 that was overtaxed. So up here, at least in Colorado, that thing was wheezing all the time. We were constantly roasting third gear trying to get up and over the pass. We drove that thing back and forth from Colorado to California about a half a dozen times.
Yeah.
And my wife beat the hell out of it. So it was a pretty sturdy vehicle to put up with her. So there's a lot of good. Yeah, I'm on the fence. I think I'll agree because it's kind of undervalued for what it is, which is something that has a little tiny bit of fun, even though it really is a mom and dad vehicle taking kids to the soccer match.
I think it's just funky, so that's why I put it on the list. Mercedes, I put station wagons. Mercedes is one of the few companies that are still devoted to station
wagons,
especially luxury ones.
Yes.
Like you can get an E-Class wagon. Of course, they're legendary for their AMG wagons, which they have done for a lot of years. So that's on the list. Agreed?
Oh, yeah.
Highly underappreciated.
Yeah, really underappreciated. I really wish more Americans would realize that they're just better.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So going to Mini, I've got the Roadster, which was a 2-seater convertible.
Oh, God.
You remember the Roadster?
Yes, I do.
It did ride like a cabbage cart.
Oh,
but
my God.
Pretty remarkable thing now because they're very rare. Of course, you can get a Mini convertible, but those are always 4-seaters. The Roadster and the Coupe were 2-seaters. Underappreciated or not?
They made no sense. No sense whatsoever. Because you didn't get any real performance gains out of them. You just lost riding handling, essentially. Roman and I had driven both of those. I think maybe you did, too. You may have driven.
I drove one. Yeah.
The coupe, the whole thing with the German going, it's just like having a baseball cap on backwards.
It had a little visor in the back.
Ridiculous. It was a terribly riding vehicle that had no... It went from being a Mini, which Minis are cool because you could actually use them for a little bit of utility and you could hold some people, do some stuff with them. And then they just took that away and said, oh, but this is better. It's not. It was no better. And both the convertible and the Roadster version of it, the Roadster version and the hardtop, no bueno, none. I mean, especially when you can get a regular Mini convertible or a regular Mini Cooper, they made so much more sense. These two made no sense. They don't deserve to even be remembered. In fact, I want you to forget everything you've just heard. I'm waving my two fingers like a Jedi right now.
So the cool spoilers, the lift-up spoiler on the coupe that was automatic.
Oh, dude, it's lifting up. Watch as it lifts. It's so British. No bueno.
All right.
Bad.
All right. I think they're cool because they're just rare and two-seater. All right. Nissan, third-generation Pathfinder. You've owned one or two of them. What do you think? Underrated? Everyone talks about Forerunners and they talk about Sequoias. No one talks about the Pathfinder.
Yeah, it's almost unfair for me because I am going to back this up 100%. And the reason why is because you're getting a lot of quality and strength out of a vehicle that eventually was replaced with a station wagon. This was a truck, had a truck frame. It had an independent rear suspension, unlike the other ones, but it could still tow between 5,000 and 7,000 pounds. You could get a V8 with them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which was cool. Awesome. But the 4-liter V6, the one I had, was great. There's even manual versions of these vehicles running around. Yes.
And this is pre-CVT, by the way. This is like trucky. Yeah.
This is back in the good days. Now, there were some issues. Some of the quality was a little weird. Transmission sometimes had a little bit of an issue. I had to put about $1,000 into the transmission to get it right. But other than the transmission, I really didn't have to do much with that vehicle. And I drove the crap out of it and really beat it up. And it was such a reliable vehicle. Until my daughter got crunched in it. Fortunately, she was fine with her friends, but the rear crumple zone was completely tested. So to speak, this vehicle is something that is, for those of you who tow or want a solid alternative to a Toyota 4Runner or something in that ilk, this is a great choice. It's a good, good truck.
So third-gen Pathfinder?
Yes.
Worth it? Yep, I agree. Low range, very cool.
Yep.
Suzuki SX4.
Yeah, I love those.
The little teeny.
But there's a caveat.
Okay,
there's a caveat. Yeah. Okay, the SX4, for those of you who don't know, is a small hatchback that's kind of a crossover. And it was early days crossovers when not many people had them. This thing is smaller than a RAV4.
Oh, yeah.
But it had a really good size interior. It's kind of a bubble. And
yeah, it was a bubble.
It was. And it had a real brilliant all-wheel drive system, especially if you got it with a stick. Later on, they came along with the CVT, a continuously variable transmission, not a very good one that they brought in either, and it turned it into a dog. Yeah. But your dad and I at least agreed that it was a great little car. I almost bought one of those to have a little runabout, and it would have been a lot of fun, but also parts are kind of hard to come by. It's just a kind of cool, different car, and I've seen a few of them out there on the net for $3,000 or $4,000 with some reasonable miles on them. And honestly, they're just solid, simple, cool little cars with a great all-wheel drive system.
So don't get the sedan, because the sedan was kind of crummy.
Oh, the sedan was kind of crap, but they did have a manual version of the sedan, but it was only front-wheel drive, I think.
There may have been. That does sound right.
Yeah, and then later on, the Kajashki came along and replaced it.
But the SX4, great little off-roader for what it was.
Yeah, it did great.
I mean, if that car had been around today, it would be selling a bajillion of them. Because it was like the Renegade. It was like all these little tiny crossovers before they existed.
That's exactly it. And it had pretty good ground clearance, but not crazy. It was probably like 6.5 inches. Or so, but it just, all the angles of it were right, and it just ran good, and it was comfortable, and just a really solid little car.
You agree with me?
Yes, 100%.
All right, moving to Toyota, and this one is a brand new car, and usually Toyotas aren't underappreciated. People know what they are.
Yeah.
But I think the most underappreciated Toyota in the market today is the new Sienna. Everybody has to go out and buy a Highlander or an SUV or a RAV4, but the Sienna, standard hybrid, great fuel economy. You can get it in all-wheel drive. It's a great car, or a great van.
I'm going to agree with you, as long as it's the all-wheel drive version.
Yeah, I got to get the all-wheel drive.
Yeah, because otherwise it doesn't make that much, I don't know. They're a little rough around the edges. Honda has them beat in terms of fun and performance. And then I would say that Chrysler has them beat in terms of comfort and interior styling.
Okay.
The Toyota is a solid choice. And the mileage, I drove one of these for a week. And I drove it hard. I don't drive cars lightly. And I kept getting like 30 and 40 miles per gallon. I'm like, oh, I'm hammering it. Come on, I can do worse. Nope. And the all-wheel drive system, it's not brilliant. Tommy's tested this all-wheel drive system in a variety of different vehicles.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it does the basics. I got it on a hill. It got a little out of shape. Rear end finally kicked in and moved it forward. Toyota needs to make their all-wheel drive system with the hybrids, which is, by the way, completely unique because it's just an electric motor powering the rear wheels. They need to make it a little bit more aggressive, and hopefully if they can manage to do that, perhaps this will be even a better system. But it's a really solid van, and it's the only other one you can get in the States next to the Chrysler that has all-wheel drive.
Okay, before we go to the last brand, do you miss Scion at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, any underappreciated cars in the Scion?
Yeah, range? Yeah, the TC. The Scion TC is one of the best cars in this class. I remember we brought one over and at the same time compared it to the original 86.
The FRS. Oh, yeah.
And it was faster than the FRS. It was quicker. It didn't handle better. It handled almost as good, though, even though it was a front-wheel drive car. The cool thing about the TC is that it's technically a hatchback, even though it looks like it's a coupe. It holds a lot of stuff. The back seats are half comfortable. It rides nice. The manual transmission version of it, there's a kit to make it throw a little bit less ridiculous. But In terms of its overall packaging, it was such a brilliant little car, and it's one that really deserved to get more accolades because it really was that good.
All right, I agree. TC, undervalued. I mean, it wasn't like as dynamic as the FRS, right? It wasn't
No. You couldn't drift with it or anything like that, obviously. But actually, a lot of the Scions, like the XB, especially the original XB, the Xbox.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, it was cool. I like those things.
People love them. Kids love buying them now.
It's still expensive,
them.
By the way.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. People and they still run.
Them. Yeah, oh, yeah.
But they had like, what, 90 horsepower?
Oh, it was ridiculous. You know, if that? They were pretty slow. They were based on, yeah. But people love the XB. And that brings me to Volkswagen. I have a threefer for Volkswagen.
Okay, hit it.
First up, the last generation Touareg. Fantastic car.
Yes.
Very expensive, okay. But yeah,
extremely expensive.
Easily a BMW Mercedes competitor. Mm-hmm. It was a great car.
Yeah.
The e-Golf. Underrated car. The last version of it had 125 miles range. Very reliable. Super fun to drive. We had one as a long-termer for a while. I like the e-Golf.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I didn't mind that so much. It had a good power.
And then finally, I've got the Volkswagen Alltrack, which was a lifted Volkswagen Golf wagon.
Why do you got to do me like this?
Nathan's wife almost bought one.
Oh, we were just talking about this.
Yeah.
We were so close to buying one. It was between that and the Mini, and it was a little bit more expensive than the Mini because it was a little bit newer, and it had a little bit more space, a little bit more utility. It was a manual. You could get a manual transmission.
Oh, yeah?
And my wife, I think based on cuteness and the fact that she wanted to frustrate me even further, decided to get the Mini. I don't regret it. The Mini's been really good to her. She loves it. But this would have been an excellent alternative.
Yeah.
So, yes, definitely on the Alltrack. And there's a lot of people out there who are only now appreciating them and trying to find them now that they're no longer being sold. Really, really good car. And then the Golf E, well, you know, the thing about the Golf E is that unlike a lot of the competitors out there that have a platform that is specifically built as an electric vehicle.
Yeah, it was converted.
It was converted. And as such, I think they lost a lot when they had to convert it over for weight and everything else. Imagine if they had started from the ground up like they did with the ID4.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little compromised there, but it was pretty affordable. You got a heat pump, pretty good range, 125 for the price was okay. It had fast charging, which was pretty good.
Yeah, that was good.
It was just really fun to drive. It was one of the few really fun to drive electric cars because it was a Golf, and all Golfs are fun to drive.
Yeah, I remember throwing it through some corners, and it handled a lot more like a Golf than it did an electric car, that's for sure.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, whew, what a marathon, Nathan.
Yeah, and I'm going to agree on all three of your picks for Volkswagen.
Okay, good. So, I think that the big contentious ones, are you still a no on the ZDX?
I didn't change my mind in the past 45 minutes.
ELR still a no?
Dear God, no.
And Cross Tour right out?
Oh, please no.
All right. Well, it was worth a shot, guys. Let us know what you think in the comment section below. Did we miss any underappreciated cars?
I think we did. Please let us know in the comments below. Thank you so much for watching. We appreciate it.
And we'll see you in the next episode.
Cheers.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.